Deloitte Private, offering audit, consulting, tax, and advisory professional services to allow private companies to address today's challenges and shape tomorrow's opportunities. Connect with us at deloitte.com/us/private.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Dana Perkins, and you're listening to Switched On, the BNEF podcast. Today, we have an interview with a special guest. This was recorded at our BNEF New York Summit back in April. So we're joined by Michael Weber. He is many things. The current Josie Centennial Professor in Energy Resources and Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. He's authored books on energy and power, in addition to multiple op-eds for the New York Times. He served as the Chief Science and Technology Officer at ENGIE in France, and he's the Chief Technology Officer of the investment fund Energy Impact Partners, which is backed by the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority and Microsoft. BNEF's chief editor, Ben Vickers, sat down with Michael, and together they discussed a range of topics, including how Michael was turned from a hydrogen skeptic to a believer, his optimistic views on the energy transition, and the art of entrepreneurship. If you like this podcast, make sure to subscribe to receive updates on future episodes and consider giving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This episode was recorded at our New York Summit, but we also have five other summits which take place around the world. The one coming up next is Munich, and following that is our summit alongside the B20 in New Delhi. If you'd like to know more about these summits, their agenda, or even see videos from previous summits, visit us at about.bnef.com/summit, or just click on the link that we've included in this episode description. As a reminder, BNEF does not provide investment or strategy advice, and our complete disclaimer is at the end of the show. And right now, we get to hear Ben's conversation with Michael Weber.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, these sort of podcasts, we're interested in the diversity of people's experience as well. It's, you know, often if you just come from the business side, it's all about business. If you just come from the academic side, it's all about academia. But you're an interesting person to talk with because you span both of those. But just to give a little bit of background, Energy Impact Partners, for those who don't know, it's really, really large fund, actually. 67 investments in the portfolio. 32 of those are technology, 14 in energy. Then there are 7 in industrials, 4 in materials, and 4 in communications. That's, of course, according to what we know. So that's a lot of technology, 32 investments. The funds they have include Deep Decarbonization Frontier Fund, which is invested by companies such as Duke Energy and First Energy Corp and Microsoft as well. So an interesting little world of investment. And then, of course, there's the academic side as well. Now, you combine education with hands-on investing. How does that work? And in what way is that an advantage other than to the students?
So I'm kind of professor by day and venture capitalist by night. So I get to see the corporate world where action is taken to solve our energy problems. And I also, in the world of research and teaching, trying to create an ecosystem that has a lot of ideas that hopefully someday will become investable. These different ideas from these students who are innovative, and they take the problems of climate change and energy security very seriously. So for me, it's really fun to be on different aspects of the energy sector, from the real world of getting things done and then the academic world of thinking about getting things done. And it hopefully is useful for the students because it shows them different pathways by which we might scale up solutions. Some of the students want to become investors or in the investor world or want to launch their own startups and seek investment. So maybe there's a pathway to help them chase their dreams. And from the investor side, we're always looking for the next innovator, the next great entrepreneur, the next great team to invest in, the next great technology. And so being involved in the world of academia, and which is not just university, Texas, because I go visit students at other universities, helps us cast the net wider to find those great ideas that just need capitalization, and then they'll change the world. So hopefully everybody benefits from this.
Okay, so you're a bit of a scout as well.
Totally, yeah. Scouting for talent, scouting for technologies and teams, scouting for ideas from the venture investment side, but then also for the students, trying to help them scout for money, which might be Energy by Partners, but there are other clean tech funds out there. And this is sort of the thing I've realized in a very optimistic way, is that there are plenty of good ideas. We've got a lot of good ideas out there. It's just a matter of capitalizing the right ones, and then the markets will take over and we'll all be fine.
Yeah. We can talk about how you do that and what are the sort of parameters you're maybe having to apply or the criteria you're using. But I love the fact that you describe it as fun as well, what you do.
It's very fun. I would say there's a lot of reason to have doom and gloom around climate change, that kind of thing. But I'm an optimist. I really think we've got this. I think we're going to solve it. I think we're going to solve it more profitably and quickly than people expect. I think we'll end up looking kind of seamless when we flash forward 50 years and look backwards. I'm just very optimistic. And one of the reasons I'm optimistic is because I have the honor and privilege of teaching hundreds of students a year, and they're great. They've got so many ideas. And then as an investor, we see the startups, they have to present their ideas to us. Mm-hmm. It's not a great idea. So it's hard to come away unenthused, and it really, in the end, is fun.
That's interesting. I mean, that enthusiasm, that optimism that you get from younger people as well, the new generations coming in, that's good to hear. And that sort of gives a lot of energy to the whole idea of the energy transition. But then you've got these legacy systems, right? And that goes for the investment community as much as it does for the industrial network, as much as it does for the power grid and so on. Isn't there sort of a clash there? That are we going to be able to change, not the people are changing, obviously, and the mindset is changing, but the infrastructure and the industrial systems we have?
Yeah, there are two reasons for optimism and one reason for pessimism. So the two reasons for optimism is, I'm an engineer, and to be an engineer means you have to be a problem solver. To be a problem solver means you have to believe the problem can be solved. You have to be optimistic to solve a problem. And then investments and investors have to be optimistic too. You're essentially investing in the future. So you have to be optimistic that the future will take you to a profitable or prosperous place. So optimism is at the root of the venture side of me and the engineer side of me. But the reasons why we might have pessimism is, for what you just said, there's a lot of legacy infrastructure. And can we leverage it, or do we have to replace it? And if you look at just the natural gas industry, just natural gas pipelines, compressors, tanks, and power plants in the United States, it is something like $8 trillion worth of capital investment. Maybe it's depreciated like $2 trillion or something like that. But the United States is one-fifth of the world's natural gas infrastructure. So it's like $40 trillion is the value of the capital if we had to build it tonight for the gas infrastructure around the world. Yeah. And then you add in oil and coal and nuclear and other things. So clearly, there's many tens of trillions or hundreds of trillions of dollars of stuff in the ground that we built up over the last 150 years. And the question for society and the markets and entrepreneurs and finance and policy is, do we get to leverage what we've already built, or do we have to replace it? And if we have to replace it, that probably will be more expensive than leveraging what we built. At least that's my view. And so anytime you can have an existing solution or a new solution that leverages existing capabilities, probably gets to market faster. Dropping fuels for pipelines, or hydrogen blends with methane, or even using hydrogen to form methane that you'll move through the pipes, or fuels that have the same compatibilities with the materials you might need, or using existing right-of-ways for transmission lines, or existing coal power plant sites for geothermal or small modular reactors. Leveraging is more efficient if you can do it. The risk of what I just said, though, is the incumbents who own it might not be on board with that change, or pretty happy with the current system, or would just rather not do it, or something like that. So the inherent legacy materials might slow us down. So if we're looking for a reason to be pessimistic, that's one, that this is different than software.
Right.
Software, if you make a new app, you can scale it up and send it around the world tomorrow. It's by hitting send. With energy, you got to do either wires and poles or pipes or something. There's steel in the ground. And so that builds in a delay and gives an advantage to incumbency.
Yeah. Yeah. So people are optimistic, I suppose. The IRA has come in. So there's some more money in there, but the sort of the volume of capital we're talking about is absolutely massive. For
it's big, yeah. And the U.S. government maybe can be a big investor, but should be a tenth or a fifth of the market or something. Usually, really has to be private markets have to take over. And so they can just get things nudged, but they can get the ball rolling downhill, and then it becomes an avalanche, right? So that's the exciting thing. And we've seen that happen many, many times with many technologies, including in energy, where the government, either by spending or policy, is the first mover, then the markets take over.
That's interesting. So that's where the investment fund comes in, right?
Yeah.
Energy investment fund. 60 to 70 investments. I think the largest investment I could find was $250 million. So these are small startups. These are things that are hopefully going to snowball at some point. But let's look at maybe what are the criteria. What parameters really do you apply nowadays? Looking at something that's got to transform this system so rapidly, what are the most promising things that you're really looking for?
It's a great question. So overall, there are several different funds within Energy Impact Partners, and some focus more on scaling up ideas that have already been proved, much more focused on the business risk as opposed to the technology risk. At the Frontier Fund, we're focused more on the technical risk, not the business risk, and therefore will be earlier stage, Series A, maybe Series B, sometimes seed projects that are earlier. We have funds focused on activity in Europe. We have some focus on non-traditional entrepreneurs. We have a credit fund. We have an infrastructure fund. So we have different stages of capital at different risk profiles, all organized around energy transition. So we're all about energy, making energy better. which could in some cases include things like more robust wires and poles for transmission systems. Sometimes it's better cybersecurity systems. And for Frontier Fund, it's deep decarbonization. So it's all energy transition. We have different areas of focus within the different funds and different technology risk sort of appetites, so to speak. $250 million is a big investment. That is not typical. Typical Series A investment might be $4 to $12 million for the Frontier Fund, earlier stage companies, where they've got some good intellectual property. Maybe they've demonstrated in the lab. They're going to their first pilot scale demonstration, or they've done their first pilot, doing a larger pilot, something like that. So we're looking for upside potential, must be disruptive, must have the ability to really displace or avoid a lot of CO2 emissions. And we're really focused on emissions. And there are a lot of great ideas around sustainability, like circularity. We won't invest because we're really around energy and climate, not sustainability, even though it's an investment idea and a great company. We often don't do those investments.
Interesting.
And there are some companies that have a lot of technical risk, but they're too big already. It's hard for us to, if it's already a $2 billion company, even if they have a lot of technical risk, then we're already priced out of the market. Or some of the bigger ones, they might not be a fit for us because there's not enough business risk or not enough upside potential. So it's kind of meet our criteria. In the end, we're investing in teams, not technologies.
Oh, really?
We have to believe in the team. And the team has to be innovative. They have to know how to run a company. Like a bad CEO can really tank a company. And so we really think about the quality of the team. And if we believe the technology, we believe the market space, we believe the pathway, but we don't believe in the team, we won't invest.
At Deloitte Private, our passion for innovation creates powerful opportunities. As we advise our private clients on ways to stay ahead of change, to leverage technology to drive progress, and to transform disruption into lasting value, Deloitte Private brings the service depth and breadth of Deloitte, tailored specifically to the unique demands of privately held, family-owned, and venture-backed companies. Connect with us at deloitte.com/us/private.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So there's the people skills, right? There's that scouting part of your role as well.
In the end, it's the most important determinant of whether we invest. Because even if it's a great team with so-so technology, we'll be tempted. And we think, well, we see other technologies really good. Maybe this team can look at that.
So what should a great team be able to do and be able to prove to bring you on board?
That's great. So certainly by the time they come to us, they've already proved they have some innovation. They have some idea. Mm-hmm. Usually they have a patent or some intellectual property portfolio that gives them the ability to move in the markets and protect their ideas. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it will be innovation is the key to get to us. But then we wonder, can they grow and can they scale? Can they keep the harmony in the team? Mm-hmm. If they come to us and they have 7 people, but they're going to grow to 40, well, that's a pretty difficult thing for a company to do.
Right.
And is that the right management? Can they do it or not? And a lot of times they can. Mm-hmm. And so we just have to look at that. And are they all technologists at this company, but they need to add HR or legal or finance? They need to add other skills.
Right.
So we'll look a lot at the team and people who've done it before have a track record is very appealing.
Right. The track record is quite important, isn't it?
Yeah. We have this vision. I teach entrepreneurship for freshmen at the University of Texas, by the way.
Okay.
And they're 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds coming in. And if you ask them, what does an entrepreneur look like? You see all the stereotypes come through. They think it's a white male from the Bay Area who wears a hoodie and is 21 years old, a college dropout. And we'll say, okay, name some college dropout successful entrepreneurs. And they'll say Bill Gates and Michael Dell and Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg. And they'll say, okay, name 4 more. And they can't because most entrepreneurs are 40 or older. They have experience. They know what they're doing. And they're much more diverse than you think, than what TV tells you. And so we're looking for that. It's rare that we're going to make a big investment in a college dropout. Like this kind of thing is, it makes for great TV, but it's actually quite rare. And especially in the energy space where it's so complex, we want people with operational experience. So they tend to be older and more experienced, but they say, like, I've been in the power sector for 25 years and here's the problem I'm trying to solve. I was in oil and gas. I know how to do drilling and now I'm going to apply it to geothermal.
Right, right.
We want that experience because energy is so risky and so complex. You want someone who has intuition built from years of making mistakes out in the field.
Right. Yeah. Real world experience.
Exactly.
But you're teaching entrepreneurship.
I am. Yeah. I teach entrepreneurship.
Can you teach that as well?
So I teach entrepreneurship. I teach energy and I teach thermodynamics, which we call thermogodynamics. It's a weed out class for engineering. Really hard engineering class. But so I teach the freshman entrepreneurship. And I've actually told them, I'm not sure I can teach entrepreneurship. I'm not sure it can be taught, but I think it can be learned. which is a fascinating thing.
Okay.
Like, I can teach them. I've done it. Well, I've got
three. You lay it on them.
So yeah, sort of like it can be learned. I'm not sure it can be taught, but I'll teach you what I know. And there's certain things you have to know about performers and finances and what are the terms and what's total addressable market or TAM or the different things that we use to describe the entrepreneurial opportunity. And I sort of admit up front that this is the only class I've taught for almost a decade now. I'm not even sure I can or should be. But the students come out of it really loving the course. And I guess one of the main ideas for the entrepreneurship with the class is anyone can be an entrepreneur, but it's almost up to you whether you are wired that way or want it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of students leave the course thinking, I don't want to be an entrepreneur. That's actually very valuable too.
That's very valuable, isn't it? Yeah, right.
And so at 30 students, maybe 10 emerge thinking, oh, yeah, this is for me. 10 emerge thinking, yeah, I could do this. And 10 are like, not for me. Well, that's fine. Yeah. So we'll
to recognize that early on is pretty useful.
Very useful. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But from what you're saying before, it's also about the team. So entrepreneurship is also about networking and having the team to work with, right? Or is that something that comes afterwards?
Yeah, network is important. So can you build the right team? Can you identify the right skills? Can you manage the team well? Can you set realistic goals? You want to push the team, but you have to hit your milestones. Mm-hmm. In startups that we love to see are the ones that say, here's our plan, and they hit their milestones. That means their plan was very realistic and that they are able to make progress towards the goal. They're not having to have down rounds or go ask for more money unexpectedly because things didn't go the way they wanted. So you just want people who can, you can plan and then execute. But that's hard to plan and execute if you're in an innovative space because you don't always know how it's going to go.
Yeah,
there's still a lot of risk, especially for these early stage companies. And you have to build in room for that kind of risk for failure.
It's living with that.
Yes.
Uncertainty, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Which is why it's venture investing. It's a different kind of risk profile than, say, a bank loan.
Okay, on risk profiles, because you've got the Decarbonization Frontier Fund. Now, as I said, Duke Energy and First Energy and Microsoft are invested in that fund. What sort of investment horizons are you aiming for with that fund? What does it do? Why is it deep decarbonization? And in a way, with companies like those coming in, Duke Energy, First Energy, and Microsoft, are their criteria for investing in this sort of fund different? Are their requirements different from what you'd normally get in the investment
community? So our investors don't get to dictate to us where we invest. Like, we do it based on our criteria. So there's independence on that. And well, to think about what's the future of energy and what are the market opportunities and does this startup meet the criteria for our investments or not? The Frontier Fund in particular has a longer horizon. Deep decarbonization is going to take a little longer. So
More
like 15 years instead of 8 years. Like, we're thinking longer in the future, a longer investment window than a longer harvest window.
15
so
years doesn't sound very much when you're talking about decarbonization.
It doesn't. No, I think that's the challenge. But typical venture investing will be 5 to 8 years or something like that. Right. Yeah, so it's longer horizon than typical venture. And we see this sort of rising tide lifts all boats. Like, we think the energy sector is where a lot of the investment's going to go for the next few decades. There will be a lot of opportunity for prosperity while bringing people secure, cheap, reliable, cleaner energy. I think this is very exciting to be part of that. But the horizon's like, you just to be practical, you have to get out of the lab, you have to have a pilot, you have to scale up your pilot, you have to get customers, you have to get a track record, then you get more customers. It just takes a while in energy in a way that we're not used to from, say, software or the semiconductor world.
Is this something that Duke Energy, for example, or these investors in this fund, is this something they're particularly aware of? Is it something, what are they in there just for the returns, or is there something else going on?
There are different events. We have some pure financial investors. They see that we're making better returns, or we're going to have an opportunity for better returns to others, and they put their money in. They just want to get their money out. So there's some, it's purely financial.
Right.
But for others who are in the energy sector, there's value beyond the finances because they need to understand the change that's coming because they might need to be the early customers or adopters of it. And the change might be a threat to their business models, and therefore it's better for them to evolve and be nimble, I think is the idea. And so it really sort of thinks about turning the requirements to track innovation from a cost center into a profit center is a way to think about it. Like all these utilities, these major energy companies, they spend money just keeping track of where innovation is. And one way to do that is to try out the technologies yourself with different pilot programs and that kind of thing. So there's a real intellectual value to getting a front row seat to what kinds of investments are going on.
So it gives them a little window into some of these things as well. Some of these companies are...
Yeah, they might have trouble finding the startups, but we see thousands of startups, so we can tell them the space.
You do, yeah.
Yeah, and that's valuable for these companies that wish to innovate, right? Or will be adopters of it. And I think this is the ones who want to be nimble and aren't stuck in their 1950s view of what their business model should be.
And that's changed rapidly over the last few years, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So energy investment partners, is it the energy sector, basically, that you're looking
to? Yeah, so we are, it's energy-oriented we look at energy transition, different elements of risk profile versus business risk, if we're technology versus business, but all about energy transition. And then Frontier Fund, more deep decarbonization within the energy sector. But it's not always around energy production. Sometimes it's a new energy consuming technology that might make fertilizers in a more efficient way, but would save a lot of energy at the massive fertilizer plants. So we invested in a small company called Nitricity, making nitrogen-based fertilizers at the farm in a distributed way. And so sometimes it's on the consumption side, sometimes it's on the production side. And we're also looking at the transportation side, moving electrons or molecules from place to place. How do we move it? Do we move it in carriers? Do we move it by pipe, move it by wire, whatever? So we look all up and down the energy sector, but including the consumers, not just the production.
You're also an author.
I'm an author. It's
true. I'm going to bring your books into this as well. The ones I know of, there's probably many other things you've written. But you've written something called Power Trip, The Story of Energy. It was published in 2019. And also Thirst for Power, Energy, Water, and Human Survival, which is sort of, for me, another demonstration of you bridging that gap between the theoretical world and maybe the consumer and the real world of business and investment and so on. Yeah, is that gap inevitable, basically? Or is it a... is it a gap or is it actually a zone of creativity that you occupy where you're sitting between investment and education?
Well, I feel like I have the privilege to see many different lines of sight, if that's the right way to think about it, with the different parts of the energy world, the industrial world, the investor world, the academic world. And by having that position where I see these things, I feel like I could tell the stories that maybe will capture other people and reach other audiences. And a lot of people will read books. And that book, actually, I turned it into a 6-part PBS documentary series.
Oh, it has? Oh, okay.
And so people sometimes prefer to watch it on TV as opposed to read the book. Yeah. But we've reached, through the book and the television series, probably 10 million people. And so it's a very different way to sort of evangelize around energy. And I'm very pro-energy and I'm very excited about energy. I want other people to share my passion and enthusiasm. And so the books are a way to make the stories accessible because not everyone wants to be a physicist or an engineer or a finance person. And so by putting into story form, narrative form, having these anecdotes and these historical nuggets, it's more useful for people. We get more people on board with energy is important. It's cross-cutting. Energy is changing. And this is very exciting. And so the books are a way to do that. And I've got other book projects I'm working on. And Power Trip, the TV series, has season 2 coming out in September, actually. So we did 6-hour-long episodes before. And now we got 6 more episodes coming out. And so it's just a... it's just a way to reach more people. And it's kind of the professor side of me, the teaching side. I want to teach people about energy. It's a way to do that.
That's storytelling. No, it's really important, isn't it? I think, you know, getting the message out is a little challenge we all face because the energy transition is one of the biggest stories around. I mean, what is bigger than climate change and the energy transition and so on?
I think so. I think it's sort of the defining sort of sectoral growth for the next 30 years, defining challenge for the century. So I think it is important.
It's a big opportunity too. But I wonder if it's becoming harder, actually, to communicate that narrative around the energy and what's going on. I'm thinking of the controversy around ESG, for example, and, you know, there's pushback against some of the innovation has been in the investment world. What do you think about it? Is it becoming harder or is it becoming easier?
Yeah, there's more landmines in the language we have to watch out for. The audiences will arrive into a room where maybe I'm giving a seminar or something and they'll have different viewpoints before I've ever spoken. And it does seem much more complex, but there's been a divide over climate change for a long time. So I've been at this for a couple decades. There's been a generational divide where older people tend to care less about climate change than younger people. And now we also have a political divide where depending on who you vote for might affect what kind of things you're hearing and whether you care or not. So there's a lot of like loaded terminology words that if you say this, people interpret differently depending on how they vote or where they live or where they sit in the room and this kind of thing. And so it does feel like it's a landmine to talk about it. And ESG is part of it. Climate change is part of it. Fossil fuels, renewables, people wear their jerseys for whatever side they're on. And they feel like they have to choose the side of fossil fuels or choose the side of renewables or something.
They become banners, don't they, some of these words?
Totally, yeah. And it's like a marker of what team you're on. And I'm like, no, we need energy and we want energy to be clean, safe, and reliable. Let's figure out the different ways to get there. And so it's a challenge. I would say for sure it's a challenge. And it's gotten worse on social media in many ways.
Social media, stay clear of social media.
I'm on social media a lot. And I think I think I say my most regrettable things on social media, but I reach a different audience that way as well. And there's some people who might follow me on Twitter, but aren't going to read a book or watch TV or whatever. So it is a challenge for sure. Despite the challenge of getting the language right and reaching these different audiences, for the most part, things are changing anyway. Especially this cultural change where because younger people, as they get older, are taking positions of authority, they're serious about it. As older people who were not serious retire, their voice will matter less. So it seems like it's really happening and it feels like the pace is picking up, frankly.
Yeah. They just have a different worldview, maybe. Sort of unwittingly, we've given, you know, circumstances have led them to a different worldview.
Totally. So when I think of these students, I've taught thousands of students in person and I've taught thousands of people, probably 10,000 people at this point online. So I've taught a lot of students and they really see it as their Cold War, their multi-decade generation defining challenge. That means that peace and prosperity are on the line and they have to win. It is a fascinating thing to see. And the same solutions will be, we need technical innovation, we need collaboration, we need strong institutions. The same answers for the Cold War, the same answers for climate change. And the students are at it and they said, this is my career. I'm going to spend 30, 40 years doing it. And my mentor when I was undergrad was a Cold Warrior. He spent his entire career trying to win the Cold War. It was his career defining thing. And I see that repeating with students. And what's funny, if you think of it like the Cold War, maybe even World War II, at some point, it doesn't matter what it costs. You think peace and prosperity on the line, we have to win, doesn't matter what it costs. Mm-hmm. And then what you find out when you win is that was the economically beneficial path anyway. It was good for the economy to win World War II. It was good for the economy to win the Cold War. It will be good for the economy and already is good for the economy to tackle climate change. Yeah, that's the way they see it. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, all power to you. We need you. So this is really fantastic.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea that it can give some sort of direction to whole careers.
So Deloitte Private. Private companies seek bold innovation, sector-defining ideas, and clear roadmaps for technology and workforce transformation. Deloitte Private's tailored services and solutions and cutting-edge tools can allow private companies to gain access to industry insights that you can use to identify opportunities and build your future. Connect with us at Deloitte.com/US/private.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
So back to the reality of investment, I suppose. I was going to ask you about the technologies that you find most interesting that are coming up over the next few years. But let's take bankability as the point that they need to reach. What is it that most excites you about what's the innovations that you're looking at the moment? But in terms of what actually is not too far out there, but is realizable within the next few years.
There are so many exciting. First of all, the first excitement is there are so many good ideas. Like that is just like an overwhelming thing. Like, oh, wow, there's a lot of good ideas that you don't get to see if you're not an investor. Because if you're an investor, people want your money. They will show you their ideas. And so there's more good ideas than I realized, which is a good thing. I guess, okay, there's a lot of ideas. Which ones are we going to capitalize? There are very exciting ones that we know will change the world if they work, like fusion. I mean, everyone
fusion?
Knows.
Are you,
And we have invested in Zap Energy. We have invested in fusion. If fusion works, it will change the world. We all know that.
That's a big one. That's
very big one. Yeah. And it's also hard to invest early stage because fusion companies, as they make progress, become worth billions of dollars very quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for a venture fund.
But how likely is that to come together? How is that?
It's unlikely. It's small likelihood, but its impact would be so large, you just have to invest. So, and in fact, there's been multiple articles in Bloomberg just like 2 days ago all about the fusion companies out there that might change the world.
There's so many of them.
Yeah. So there's a lot more attention in Bloomberg and other outlets really covering this, which I think is really exciting. So it's become kind of mainstream. Doesn't mean we'll have a fusion plant next year. Still could be many years or decades, right? But it's exciting to see private money coming to it, not just government money. Yeah. That's exciting. I'm excited about energy storage. Energy storage has been the solution for like 20 years. We've been saying for 20 years, if we just had a better battery or a better way to do storage. And it feels like the markets have answered with lithium ion batteries for our smartphones and electric cars. But there are other chemistries out there that either don't degrade or have longer duration. We've invested in companies like Form Energy, which is a long duration battery. So this is very exciting in the energy storage space. Another area of excitement for me that's really interesting is around hydrogen. And hydrogen's fascinating for me because
the hydrogen's come and gone many times.
Right? Oh, many times. I mean, if you go back to the 1800s in Phantom of the Opera, I don't know if you read the book or seen the movie, but the author, Gaston Leroux, wrote in 1910 about the late 1800s Paris Opera House, how they use hydrogen methane blends to change the brightness of the stage lighting. So we talked today about hydrogen methane blends as innovative and world changing. And in fact, French authors had tackled that by the 1880s. And Jules Verne wrote about it in the 1870s with the Mysterious Island. We're using hydrogen from water electrolysis to run a fuel cell. So hydrogen's not new, but it's attracting some private capital and there's new ways to go about it. And for me, I was a professional hydrogen skeptic for about 10 years.
Were you really?
from about 2007 to 2018, I just...
Why were you skeptical?
It's just so thermodynamically stupid to take electricity, to split water, to make electricity. Right. And I just was really critical. Like it's not an original resource. It is something you have to extract from other resources. Doesn't make sense. But then 2018, as I started to work with Engie, I realized how many different ways there are to make make and use hydrogen.
This is NG
in Paris, France. I was their chief science and technology officer, and we had a hydrogen lab, and I was meeting with the team. I just kind of had my eyes opened up. Okay, there's more to hydrogen than using a coal-fired power plant to split water to make electricity. And in particular, there are many ways to make hydrogen. So electrolysis, using electricity to split water, gets a lot of the headlines. Steam methane reforming actually is where we make a lot of our hydrogen. And actually, coal gasification is another one. So coal and natural gas are where we make our hydrogen today. Maybe we'll make it from electrolysis in the future. But there are other ways to make it. There's pyrolysis and photolysis and radiolysis and catalysis and thermolysis. There are all these other pathways that are potentially much more efficient because they use a different feedstock, or they use degraded waste heat or something. They're not using new energy. And so you start to open your mind beyond the two pathways we see, or the third that's looming, to all the ways you might make hydrogen. It gets pretty exciting. And then you start to think of all the ways we might use hydrogen. It gets pretty exciting. And then if you think of all the excess, really cheap wind and solar electricity you might have, electrolysis starts to make sense. Now, I think hydrogen is not going to replace bulk energy, but there are things like chemicals and industrial heat and aviation and marine shipping where hydrogen might play a pretty important role. And so that's kind of exciting for us. And we're looking at that as well.
What's interesting also in what you said is that up until 2018, and then suddenly your eyes were opened by you know, being somewhere and going to a lab and seeing something differently. And you'd had a career in this
field. I was the guy you trotted out to make fun of hydrogen. And then I went to a corporate lab that was working on it. And that's where it's good for me as a professor to get into the real world, because the real world says, well, I know you're skeptical, but here's the progress we made in the last 40 years. We've been looking at this for a while. Yeah. And I just learned a lot. And it was very good for me to get that education.
That's fascinating. This is fascinating. We could probably go on. We'll have to do another one at some point.
We'll do another one. We'll do a follow on. There's so much to talk about. Energy is a rich topic to work with.
Fantastic. Mike Weber, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Bloomberg NEF is a service provided by Bloomberg Finance LP and its affiliates. This recording does not constitute, nor should it be construed as, investment advice, investment recommendations, or a recommendation as to an investment or other strategy. Bloomberg NEF should not be considered as information sufficient upon which to base an investment decision. Neither Bloomberg Finance LP nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.